In the matter of Diane Lapsley versus the Township of Sparta and Sparta Public Library, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Justices. William Johnson on behalf of Paul Austin and the Sparta Department of Public Works.
Good morning, Justices. John R. Tort Jr., firm Leitner Tort DeFazio, on behalf of the Township of Sparta and the
Sparta Public Library.
Good morning, Justices. Christine McCarthy from the law firm of Einhorn Barbarito Frost and Botwinick on behalf of the respondent, Diane S. Lapsley.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Johnson, please go ahead.
At the outset, may I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
May it please the court. As the record reflects, workers' compensation judge Michael Luther decided the issue of whether Mrs. Lapsley's injuries were compensable based upon a stipulated set of facts. Relying on this court's legal precedent, he ruled that her injuries were compensable. The appellate division reversed, ruling that for injuries to public employees to be compensable, not only must the employer own the location of the accident, it must also control the employee's use of that location. That added element is inconsistent with the previous decisions of this court, and for that reason, the appellate division's decision must be reversed. Ms. Lapsley was an employee of Sparta as a librarian at the library. The library is located within a complex which contains the library, playing fields, and 3 parking lots, including the one immediately adjacent to the library. The lots are open to the public as well as to employees of and visitors to the library. The lot adjacent to the library where this accident occurred is owned, maintained, and controlled by the Township of Sparta. Sparta uses the lot both for its employees and for visitors to the library and other town-owned properties in the complex. At the time of the accident, the lot was being plowed by Mr. Austin, who was employed by Sparta as a snowplow operator. Mrs. Lapsley was walking with her husband across the parking lot to his vehicle when they were struck by the plow. The stipulated facts established that Ms. Lapsley's owner owned, maintained, and controlled the area where the accident occurred. The facts established that Ms. Lapsley was injured by a fellow employee, and the facts established that Ms. Lapsley was in the parking lot because she had just finished her workday at the library and not for some purpose unconnected to her employment. The analysis of whether Ms. Lapsley's injuries are compensable starts with an examination of the language of the workers' compensation statute. NJSA 34:15-36 provides in part as follows. Employment shall be deemed to commence when an employee arrives at the employer's place of employment to report for work and shall terminate when the employee leaves the employer's place of employment, excluding areas not under the control of the employer. The question, therefore, is whether Ms. Lapsley was injured at her place of employment. In other words, was the town-owned parking lot immediately adjacent to the library included within her place of employment? Judge Luther correctly ruled that it was, and as a result, found that her injuries were compensable. In 1979, the legislature amended the workers' compensation statute to replace the going and coming rule with the premises rule. In Livingstone versus Abraham and Strauss, this court applied the premises rule to find compensability for an individual who was struck by a vehicle being operated by a fellow employee as she walked from an area of a mall parking lot where she had been told to park. This court reviewed previous cases where employees had been injured in parking lots and concluded that the legislature did not intend to overturn those decisions when it adopted the premises rule. Those decisions generally hold that parking lots owned, maintained, or used by employers for employee parking are part of the employer's premises. Importantly, Livingstone did not require that the employer have exclusive use of the parking lot. This court specifically stated, quote, the fact that ANS neither owned, maintained, nor had the right exclusively to use this area of the lot does not, in our view, render her injuries non-compensable. Approximately 10 years later, this court decided the Christensen versus Morgan case. There, the employee worked for the New Jersey Department of Transportation as a bridge operator. The bridge operators work in 3 shacks located on the bridge. As Mr. Christensen was leaving work and walking on the bridge to his car, he was unfortunately struck by a vehicle and killed. His estate filed both a claim petition and a wrongful death lawsuit in the law division against Mr. Christensen's employer, the New Jersey Department of Transportation, which owned the bridge. This court concluded that the injuries were compensable and that the workers' compensation bar precluded the estate from pursuing a wrongful death lawsuit against NJDOT. This court articulated the analysis as follows, quote, "The pivotal questions under the premises rule are, one, where was the situs of the accident, and two, did the employer have control of the property on which the accident occurred?" The court went on to state that, quote, "Although the act does not define control, this court has stated that control exists when the employer owns, maintains, or has exclusive use of the property. Here, NJDOT owned, maintained, and controlled the bridge where the decedent worked and was fatally injured." That same year, this court decided the Ramos versus M&F Fashions. The employee was injured when he fell into an elevator shaft on his way to work. This court found that the employer controlled the elevator by its use of the elevator in the conduct of its business. In addition, the court stated that the fact that M&F did not have exclusive control of the elevator did not place it beyond M&F's workplace premises. Brower versus ICT Group, a decision which this court decided in 2000, is factually similar to Ramos. There, an employee had ended her workday, punched out, and was descending steps leading from the street to her workplace in a multi-tenant office building when she fell and was injured. The stairway was one of three means of access to the employer's premises. She filed a claim for workers' compensation, which was denied by the employer and both the Workers' Compensation Court and the Appeal Division. The court ruled that the accident was compensable. This court stated, the fact, quote, "The fact that a petitioner had punched out on the time clock does not preclude compensability because the situs of the accident and the employer's control of that location are dispositive factors." The court went on to conclude that the fact that the employer knew its employees regularly used that stairwell was enough to establish control. The next, and what appears to be the last time this court addressed the issue, was the Hirsch versus County of Morris case. There, the petitioner was an employee of the County of Morris. She was permitted to park her vehicle in one of several parking garages rented by the county in a privately owned parking garage. On the date in question, she had parked her vehicle and was walking across a public street when she was struck by a motor vehicle and injured. The plaintiff filed a workers' compensation claims petition, which was opposed. Both the workers' compensation judge and the appellate division held that the plaintiff's injuries were compensable. The county appealed to this court. In your analysis, this court found that neither the parking garage where the plaintiff had parked her vehicle nor the public street on which she had been injured were owned, controlled, or maintained by the county. And as a result, you held that in the circumstances of that case, an employer who was injured on a public street not controlled by the employer is not entitled to compensation. Of all the cases that this court has decided since the 1979 amendments to the Workers' Compensation Act, only one addresses a situation where the situs of the accident is owned and maintained by the employer. In all those other cases, you were addressing the issue of whether a claim could be compensable even though the employer did not own that location. The case that I'm referring to is the Christensen case. The analysis developed in the Christensen case and applied in Hirsch is where did the accident occur and did the employer have control of that area? Here, the accident occurred on a parking lot owned, maintained, and controlled by Mrs. Lapsley's employer, the Township of Sparta. In this case, the appellate division did not need to reach the issue that Livingstone, Ramos, Brower, and Hirsch did and examine whether, even though the employer did not own or maintain the situs of the accident, they exercised control over that area. The issue was resolved by the undisputed facts that Sparta owns, maintains, and controls and uses the parking lot. However, the appellate division added another requirement for public entities like Sparta, namely that because public entities own substantial property, they must also control the route which Ms. Lapsley took to and from work in order for her injuries to be compensable. No case from this court stands for that proposition. The Christensen decision did not impose that element, even though the bridge on which the decedent was walking was open to the public, and he was struck by a motor vehicle being operated by a member of the public. In addition, Mr. Christensen worked for the NJDOT and was attempting to sue NJDOT, a public entity who also owns significant portions of property. In this case, the appellate division relied on its previous holding in the Assagoz case, stating that to find petitioner's injuries compensable would mean that any injury she suffered in any town-owned lot would be compensable. The last sentence of the appellate division's decision states, quote, "To conclude that petitioner's injuries would be compensable on any town-owned lot or roadway after leaving the library premises would be an unwarranted and overbroad expansion of public entity exposure for workers' compensation claims under the Act. Ms. Lapsley was not injured in any town-owned lot or on a town-owned roadway. She was injured in the parking lot immediately adjacent to the library, her place of employment. Although the lot was open to and used by members of the public, it was also used by town employees and visitors. The lot was owned, maintained, controlled, and used by her employer, the Township of Sparta. She was struck when a fellow employee was plowing snow. As such, this court's prior decisions lead to the conclusion that the accident occurred on her employer's premises and is compensable, and that she is barred from pursuing a claim for personal injuries against her employer and fellow employee. As a result, we would request that this court reverse the decision of the Appellate Division and rule that her injuries are compensable and that she is barred from pursuing a claim for personal injuries.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
I'm happy to answer any questions, but I have nothing to add.
Thank you. Mr. Tort.
Good morning, Justices. As I indicated, my name is John R. Tort, Jr., and I represent the petitioner, Sparta Public Library and Township of Sparta. On November 19, 2013, I stood before this learned body on the matter of Hirsch versus the County of Morris. The Hirsch decision was authored by Justice Fernandez Vina.
It was a brilliant one, wasn't it?
On his first day as a New Jersey Supreme Court Justice, actually centered around many of the same issues and circumstances as the present case before the court today. While the location of an accident and who controlled the location are rightfully much of what is analyzed in a premises rule workers' compensation case, what is often overlooked are the public policy concerns attached to these types of cases, particularly when dealing with public entities. In their decision to unilaterally reverse the premises rule, the Appellate Division has now expressed employers to the hazards of tort liability, which have the potential to be economically crippling. This also prohibits employees from the benefits of the Workers' Compensation Act, which was constructed as humane social legislation. If left unrevised, that decision will likely cause substantial economic consequences to the state's public as well as the private employers. Furthermore, it is inconsistent with the public policy and goes against legislative intent of the Workers' Compensation Act. Because of the ameliorative effect that the Workers' Compensation was intended to have, including swift recompense for injured employees, it is rightfully characterized as important social legislation entitled to liberal construction as set forth in its introduction. The statute is to be construed to bring as many cases as possible within its coverage. The Appellate Division erroneously assumes public policy somehow favors tort liability over workers' compensation claims, which is quite the opposite. For example, if an employee slips on ice in your parking lot and is injured, some form of litigation is likely to follow. The question becomes, who would rather be subjected to tort liability or have that litigation couched in terms of a workers' compensation cause of action? In workers' compensation, the level of an employee's injuries is determined on a fixed schedule of permanent disability to specific parts of the body. In keeping any potential recovery in terms of workers' compensation and not tort liability is not without benefit to the injured worker. Under workers' compensation law, the worker does not have to prove fault or negligence of their employer. This no-fault system with a smaller scale discovery practice provides for a more streamlined recovery for the injured party. The exclusive remedy provision of the Workers' Compensation Act is a compromise between the employer and the employee. The exclusive remedy is designed to maintain the balance of sacrifices between major employer and employee in the substitution of no-fault liability for tort liability. The Supreme Court in Dudley versus Victor Lynn Lines, Inc., 32 NJ 479, explained that by accepting the benefits of the act, the employer assumes absolute liability but gains immunity from common law suit, even if he was negligent, and the employee foregoes the right to sue his employer for negligence but gains a speedy and certain measure of damages for all work-connected injuries. It is important to note, from the onset of this claim, the matter was admitted as a compensable incident by the employer. Unfortunately, the employer's acceptance of the claim was rejected by the injured worker's attorney. In fact, counsel instructed the employer not to make any payments and that the petitioner rejected the compensation benefits. Again, the Township of Sparta determined the injuries in this matter arose from an admitted incident and were compensable in nature. However, they were precluded from paying medical or temporary disability benefits as counsel would not accept same while attempting to put forward a civil liability lawsuit against this public entity. In the Hirsch decision, the court set forth the consistent measure of analyzing compensability in premises rule cases has been and still remains the test for first discussed in the Livingston case and utilized in the Christensen and most recently articulated in the Hirsch case. While Livingston and Christensen, as well as the case before the court today, it appears that the tests were met. In Hirsch, the test was not met, resulting in a contrary finding by this court. With all of the different factual nuances and outside factors in the long lineage of cases involving what was first the going and coming rule and later the premises rule, the test reminds us the pivotal questions under the premises rule was where the situs of the accident and did the employer have control of the property on which the accident occurred. And in this case, this test was met. The appellate division for decades has enforced the careful crafted two-factor test when deciding compensability in premises rule cases, the factors being the situs, location of the accident, and the level of control the employer had over the location. Most recently, in the Hirsch case, this very court made it clear our test, with its well-established tandem of factors, remained controlling. The appellate division here has unilaterally created a third factor to the court's test, being an employer's exclusive use of its parking lot as a decisive factor in determining compensability. If allowed to move forward with this modification on the test, it will amount to no less than exactly what this court has worked diligently to stave off: unwarranted expansion of the factors in analyzing a premises rule case. In analyzing a scenario like ours involving a lot owned and maintained by the employer at the moment of an accident involving an employee and a co-employee occupying the lot while in their normal egress by direct evacuation of the order of the employer, it is clear this demonstrates control of both the person and the premises and must result in a finding of compensability under the Workers' Compensation Act. And for the reasons I have set forth here today and pursuant to New Jersey Supreme Court precedent, it is respectfully requested the decision of the appellate division to be reversed and the decision of the Workers' Compensation Judge Michael J. Luther be upheld.
Any questions? Anything you'd like to amplify?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Tort. Ms. McCarthy.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. Diane Lapsley was severely injured when she was struck by a snowplow that was operated by an employee of the Township of Sparta as she was walking with her husband in a common area multi-use parking lot after her shift had ended and well far away outside of the library, which is her workplace. The Township of Sparta is now attempting to use the premises rule as a shield to escape third-party liability. They're arguing that Diane's status as an employee blankets her wherever she goes and would apply whenever she's injured on premises owned and maintained by her employer. They would have you accept an argument that the same fact pattern arose, but Diane walked across to the baseball field or the football field that shared the same parking lot within that municipal complex, and she was struck by a baseball or bitten by a dog, her injury would be compensable. That just seems illogical. This case is not the Christensen case, where the bridge operator, the employee, was injured on the bridge service where he worked. Diane was a librarian. She worked in the library. She didn't work in the parking lot. She had absolutely no duties whatsoever in the parking lot. Additionally, in Christensen, the employee was exposed to an additional hazard. The only way for him to get on or off the bridge was to cross a four-lane highway at 11:15 at night without a crosswalk and multiple witnesses confirming that it was very dark and not well lit. Diane did not face any of those risks. She was walking in a common area parking lot like any member of the public could and would. Instead, this case is much more similar to the Hirsch case because just like Hirsch's route, the lot could be utilized by any member of the public and her route did not expose her to any additional or added hazards that a normal member of the public, not an employee, would face. In fact, her husband was struck by the very same snowplow. That fact in and of itself demonstrates that risk occasioned by Diane was not unique to employees. This court should uphold the unanimous decision of the appellate division because if ownership and maintenance alone are sufficient to determine compensability, the floodgates of workers' compensation to public employees could open. That's at odds with the legislative intent of the 1979 amendment. The intent being to provide genuine reform and cost containment measures to New Jersey's employers from unjustified workers' compensation costs, which were at that time amongst the highest in the nation. As in Hirsch, this court instructed that the Workers' Compensation Act does not invite expansive interpretations that would resurrect the going and coming rule, which is essentially what petitioners are arguing. Using their definition of ownership and maintenance, any time a public employee is injured on public employer-owned land, that injury would be compensable without any nexus to employment whatsoever. This could serve as a workaround to the Torts Claim Act, because the Torts Claim Act would normally bar certain claims, as there's immunities and other prohibitions. Claims that would be barred by that act would now become viable under the workers' compensation, under the guise of a Workers' Compensation Act. We're asking this court to harmonize the goals of the workers' comp and legislation and the public policy of public cost containment to public entities. The legislature clearly deemed it appropriate to limit workers' compensations to confined, manageable areas by enacting the premises rule in order to calculate and predict employers' exposure. There must be a reasonable line where workers' compensation ends. Therefore, we're asking that the reasonable line be tied to control, which is in line with the statute and the legislative intent, to have some reasonable basis for public entities to anticipate costs. So the elements of control, as mentioned in prior case law, could be perhaps the employer directs the employee where to park, or their route exposes the employee to additional hazards that a member of the public would not face. If this court accepts petitioner's argument, workers' compensation claims against public entities may increase dramatically, paving the way for municipal employees injured on their commute home, but still on public employer-owned land to succeed in a workers' compensation claim, effectively resuscitating the going and coming rule, which has come and gone.
Counsel, do you agree that your argument and the appellate division apparently agreed that adding the dimension of requiring control or direction by the employer telling the employee to use a particular lot, a publicly owned lot, is necessary here, that control piece has only appeared in our case law when it was dealing with parking areas that were not owned by public entities? Because I can't find another case that used that piece that was added here outside of that setting.
With public employers, it does make sense to follow that same logic because they own such broad expanses of land. For instance, the Township of Sparta owns 97 miles of roadway and 39 square miles.
My question is, have we ever said that the employer directing the employee to use a particular public lot was necessary for the control piece on premises analysis? The control piece has only ever arisen when an employer directed an employee to use, as in Hirsch, a privately owned parking that was being made available to employees.
This court, no, the closest case to it is the Christensen case, but the court never needed to get to that element of control because he was injured in his workspace, which was the bridge.
So you agree that this new piece that's being added by the appellate division is nowhere in our case law setting?
It's nowhere in the case law as applied to public employers, but the element of control is not new.
But it's a specific kind of control that's being used here. And let me make my point more clear. You're looking for us to add a direction that the public employee tell its employees where to park in a public lot owned by the municipality in order for workers' comp to cover. That's what you're asking us to hold.
And not in if there's, this is, would apply to a specific set of facts, like in Lapsley here, it was a multi-use parking lot. If this were a library parking lot, I think it would be a different, because there would be exclusive use by the library.
The facts here is this is the adjacent public parking lot to this building. How much closer need it be?
It was a municipal complex with three different parking
that,
lots.
I understand that, but it's adjacent to the public building, is it not?
There was a sidewalk that separated. You don't step out immediately and hit the side. You don't step out of the library and immediately.
Granted.
But
do you agree it was adjacent to the building?
I agree that it was a multi-use parking lot, that the fields were adjacent to it as well.
Let's talk about this in practical terms, because I understand your emphasis on the words multi-use. Isn't in practice this the equivalent of an employee parking lot that an employer provided while at the same time allowing for additional uses? It's owned, it's controlled, it's owned, it's maintained, it's adjacent, it's free. Doesn't this seem, in practical terms, to be the equivalent of an employee parking lot?
It's not necessarily an employee, it's a parking lot. It's not necessarily an employee, there was no direction that employees needed to park there. And in fact, in this case, she wasn't even walking to her own vehicle. She was walking to her husband's vehicle.
From the perspective, and this is not how we will analyze this under the law, but from the perspective of an employee, where else would they park?
They could park in any one of those three lots. They could park along the street. They could walk.
That defies common sense. You know, it's people try to park as close to the building where they work as possible. I remember when I was in private practice, it's in an office building, and people would circle for 15 minutes to get 10 feet closer to the building rather than to walk 15 extra feet. That tells me something about human nature. Do you think that's a common sense thing, that people try to park as close to their building of employment as possible?
I do think that is common sense, but there's no direction here for the employee.
It doesn't have to be direction. It's an adjacent parking lot. And therefore, the employer would know that its employees are going to be likely parking there as close to the building as possible.
Well, I think the facts change. If this is an exclusive parking lot that's just for the library, then I think that changes. When it's in a complex, how would you delineate?
What's the difference? Let's say the library has 10 employees, and the parking lot adjacent allows for 50 parking spots, accounting for 40 customers. What's the difference?
Well, because then ownership and maintenance could extend for the entire and everything that Sparta Township owns.
So we're dealing with the adjacent parking lot, not with the ball field where she could have been hit with a wiffle ball or a baseball or some stray dog. We don't have to go that far in this case, do we?
It is the same parking lot.
Can I just pick up on something your adversary mentioned. In many municipalities, I think Justice Alvin touched on it, particularly small municipalities, there are municipal buildings with municipal parking lots that act as public parking lots for the town. There's shopping in town, there are libraries in town, and people will park in the municipal parking lot but walk to other town activities. Would your contention apply to the municipal clerk who walks out one day and trips and falls in the parking lot? Would your rule apply to them?
It would be highly dependent on the facts of the case.
Say the facts are they walk into the parking lot and the Department of Public Works plow truck hits them as they're walking from the building to their spot where they parked in the lot.
If it's a multi-use parking lot, yes, it would be.
It's a public parking lot.
Yes, it would be the same contention. And the Torts Claim Act there picks up. So it's not as if someone wouldn't be without a remedy.
Well, they might have a personal injury action as you're seeking to bring here. But I'm suggesting in the case that I think they were referring to, where the municipality builds a lot for public parking to service the employees of their various municipal buildings in that area, but also the public does park there adjacent to the municipal building, that person would be entitled to recover against the municipality.
If there were some sort of prescription, if there was assigned spots or something like that,
no,
or some control.
No, just municipal parking lot, as Justice Alvin said, you've got 10 or 15 people in the municipal lot and it has 100 spots.
The issue with that is because then there is no line. If it becomes a compensable injury, what happens if that employee walks, 10 feet down the sidewalk to go into another store, no longer connected to their work that is part of their commute home but want to stay home? Just using ownership and maintenance alone in this context it creates too much liability and too much stress upon municipalities.
When you said earlier it is the same parking lot, in response to Justice Alvin's question, how many parking lots are there?
There's three parking lots that are all within the complex.
So the hypothetical that you and he discussed related to the other two parking lots, not the adjacent one, isn't it a different parking lot?
It's not necessarily adjacent to the library. It's kind of in between the ball field and the library. And there's a roadway, a pathway in between the library before you get to where the lined spots are.
Go ahead. Sorry.
She didn't park anywhere, but had any employee parked in any of the three lots, it's still a township lot.
What are we to make of our language in Livingstone, which concededly a different case, but where we said, and you heard the quotation from your adversary, we're persuaded that the legislature impliedly approved of the principle established by those cases, and cases cited in the opinion, namely that lots owned, maintained, or used by employers for employee parking are part of the employer's premises. That's what we said. What do you think we meant?
Well, what makes it different, especially with a private employee, and what was emphasized in Livingstone, that by requiring the employees to park further away, it's reserved spots for customers, giving them an economic advantage. Here, towns aren't in business to make money.
Livingstone was an expansion of what I just read to you, because A&S did not own the parking lot. All they did was tell their people to park further down, and that's what we meant by control. Control the employees, because we told them where to park, even though it wasn't on their premises. But the piece that I quoted to you is saying that part of your workplace is the parking lot. That's what that says.
And
no? Am I mistaken?
No, you're correct. But further on in Novus Rosenbluth Travel and Serrano v. Apple Container, the court also said that the Livingstone is not to be overread. And not to be to reinvigorate the going
and coming. Not to be over it because A&S didn't maintain or own the parking lot. We didn't want to expand that. That's the reason why in Hirsch we wound up putting limits. But here the parking lot is owned and maintained by the township. And the employee was struck, what, 18 feet out the door?
Well, she walked down a sidewalk and in 18 feet into the parking lot. It wasn't immediately as if she stepped right out of the library and was struck by the snowplow. She had a reasonable expectation of when her workday ended. And in Livingstone, as with a private entity, the court also said that it makes sense to pass along those costs to a business because they can incorporate that as the cost of doing business. Here, for a public employer, that doesn't make sense to pass along costs to...
Can I say, make one observation? You sound like you're representing the township. You're making a better case for savings for municipalities than I've heard from the municipality. Yes?
I understand that, and it might be an interesting position for us to take.
Obviously, that cuts both ways, though, because there's a third-party action underway.
Yes.
And the township is making arguments that the ultimate burden of a third-party action would circumvent the Workers' Compensation Act.
Right, but the Torts Claim Act already exists to protect municipalities. The legislature already wrote in, you know, laws that protect. As in the earlier argument, they were emphasizing that immunity is the rule.
But the Tort Claims Act doesn't in any way negate the legislative intent of the Workers' Compensation Act.
No, but it can fill in where the Workers' Compensation Act ends. It can now fill in for a situation like this to protect, as the Workers' Compensation Act, the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act to provide minimal compensation to injured employees, and the purpose of the Torts Claim Act to protect public entities.
And provide much larger recoveries for injured individuals.
Well,
coming out of the town's coffers also through their insurance carrier.
Correct, but this gives an injured party the opportunity to be made whole, where workers' compensation does not do that.
Can you address the statement of black letter law in Christensen, which we've already heard in the argument from your colleagues across the aisle, that control exists when the employer owns, maintains, or has exclusive use of the property. Why is that not met here?
Well, although the Township of Sparta is her employer, she worked as a librarian. So the library, her employer, did not have exclusive use of the property.
Right, but this passage that I just read to you, a statement of our law, uses the disjunctive. It doesn't require exclusive use.
Christensen also doesn't necessarily apply to this case because he was injured on the bridge service where he worked. Diane, and they even liken it, the court goes on in Christensen to liken it to an employee who punches out on their time clock and is injured as they're walking through the plant under the way to their car.
Are you arguing with the statement of law or something else? Are you saying this is an incorrect statement of law?
I'm not saying it's an incorrect statement of law. I'm just saying it's not applicable here because the Christensen statement of law was clearly dealing, because even at the end of the case, it says they do not need to address control of the parking lot.
Anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
No, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, did you want to offer rebuttal?
Just briefly, and I want to pick up on something that Justice LaVecchia said. There has never been a case from this court where you analyzed the issue of control of the employer, of the employee in their use of property that was not owned by the employer. So that's what the appellate division wrongly did here, is they did not follow your precedent. They decided that because public employers own vast expanses of property, and because we're worried that if we rule this way, somebody who's killed in an automobile accident 3 miles away from the area of their employment would be able to pursue workers' compensation claim benefits. That's not the facts in this case. The facts in this case is that she left her workplace, walked across a sidewalk, walked into a parking lot. The roadway is an interior roadway within the parking lot where cars drive to get to their places. It's not an actual roadway. And then was struck. That's the employer's premises. So quite simply, this is not unlike any other parking lot case that you've analyzed over the course of since the beginning of the Workers' Compensation Act. It's no different than those, and the same standard should apply. We own the lot. She was there at the work premises because she had just finished her work day. Therefore, she's entitled to workers' compensation claim benefits, and we're entitled to assert the bar against pursuing a tort claim against us. Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. Court's in recess.